It's been 5 years since Papua New Guinea held an election. And in those 5 years, no woman served in the national parliament, despite a record number standing in 2017's election. To date, only 7 women have democratically won the right to represent their communities in Papua New Guinea's parliament. But this June, the people of Papua New Guinea will go to the polls to decide who will represent them, and it's hoped that that number will change. Hello, and welcome to the AusPNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast where we talk about Papua New Guinea's pressing issues for women seeking greater political representation. My name is Jessica Collins, and I'm a research fellow here at the Institute. And I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Tanya Bale, who is currently a female candidate for Papua New Guinea's upcoming national election, and she is part of the female force looking to turn those numbers around. Tanya, welcome and hello.
Hi, thank you.
Tanya, I'm always interested in people's pathways into politics, so let's start by hearing your story. What was your life and career like before entering politics?
I grew up in a political family. My mother was a former candidate. Well, she was a candidate for the seat that I'll be contesting in, actually. But she, you know, her two older brothers served as members of parliament. I've had two of my cousin brothers serve as members of parliament. So I grew up in a political family. I also grew up in a media family with my father working in broadcasting. So, you know, when you're working in media as well, there's you know, politics is obviously something that's discussed quite a lot. My mother also served on the Constitutional Planning Committee for Papua New Guinea. So I grew up with a deep understanding of, you know, our nation's constitution, you know, the thinking behind our founding fathers as to their vision for this country. So I personally, in my career, went into a career in the media, in journalism and as a television host. But you know, politics has always just been there, you know, not in the background, in very much in the foreground for me throughout my life.
Wow, that is such a rich political history for your family. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that later in our chat. But first, I'd just love to hear about your advocacy for social justice and the empowerment of women and youth in Papua New Guinea. You've done a lot of that in your time in the lead up to nominating for this election, haven't you?
Yeah, advocacy. I mean, I guess, you know, when you grow up watching your mother do it, you know, advocating for really those that are the most vulnerable in our society, it just seems like a thing that you're supposed to do. And so working in the media and through, you know, the platform of the television programs that I've produced and hosted and reported for, I've always been able to give voice to these kind of issues that are affecting our most vulnerable in our society. But of course, it does, after so many decades, become a little bit frustrating that you see you want to do more. You feel like you're just telling other people's stories, And of course, there's value in that for them, because when you create awareness and exposure, often things can get done. But I've always had a sense that I felt like, you know, I need to do more. Like there needs to be more to be done. So, you know, it's just an extension of the work that I've done in my professional space. It's just kind of like an extra add-on to that, where, you know, the cameras stop rolling, the interview stops, but you don't stop connecting with those people and those issues, because it's hard to stop. You can't. You think about them all the time. People share their struggles with you, people share their stories with you, and you can see that when they do, there's always that glimmer of hope that they in their eyes when they look at you, as if, you know, you might be able to help them. And so it's pretty hard to ignore. So I try very much to use my profile and my connections and networks to do things off camera that can take, you know, things further towards improving the lives of people.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly important work, Tanya, but, you know, it takes a lot of courage to run for office, and especially in Papua New Guinea where, you know, well over 3,000 people were candidates in 2017. Of that huge group, women made only 5% of the candidacy, so that was about 150 women, but, you know, still none were successful. So tell me about that moment when you decided to take it that step further. Do you remember the moment when you first realised that you wanted to stand for office?
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit different for me, I guess, than others, because, you know, as we all learn from our parents, and so I have a mother who contested, and to a degree there was kind of an expectation, you know, that I would be doing this from within my family. So if in many ways I ran away from it, because I know what is involved. You know, there's no illusions, you know, from me around what's involved in campaigning. I saw my mother do it 3 times and the sacrifice that's involved with that. And then, of course, I know I'm well aware of the responsibility and the sacrifice when you actually get into parliament. Your life is no longer yours. You are there to serve people and do the work. So it was more a matter of steeling myself for the task ahead and finding the right time to actually press go. So I was back in my home country in the last elections after a couple of decades working abroad, just going about my career, slowly coming back and reconnecting with the Pacific and then Papua New Guinea. I felt like I'd been home for 2 years at the last election. I didn't feel like I was ready yet, as in just to settle in and become familiar with the playing field and become familiar with the nuances and the issues. And this time around, I just figured if I don't do it now, I'm not going to do it. And then if I don't do it, then I know that I will forever be wondering what if. So it was more a case of waiting for the right time and making sure that I was ready, you know, emotionally, spiritually, you know, and just with wisdom, with really knowing and getting a really good picture of the situation. I always knew it would be this electorate. I've never lived anywhere else when I've lived in my country. I was born and raised here, and when I moved back home, I moved straight into the heartland of my electorate. I always knew it was going to be this one. So it wasn't really a case of, you know, a light bulb moment or anything. It was always there. And as I said, it was more a case of me just resigning myself to it rather than running away from it. I mean, you mentioned courage, and that's been a word that's been raised quite a lot since the announcement of my candidacy, and people have used brave and courageous quite a lot. I also throw in crazy, a little bit crazy, because I know, I know what's ahead of me, but there is a block with women. There is a block. Look, there are so many quality women in this country. We are missing out on that because of a block, like just a mindset block, I think. And courage is part of it. The hardest part for me was, you know, thinking, okay, who am I going to tell first? How am I going to, anticipating people's responses? I chose to tell the hardest people first to get the hard part out of the road, chose to tell the people that I thought would be against it first so I could practice arguing my case, and that was the right move, because I told a few people, and And the first response was, "Oh, you won't win."
Wow.
The first three responses were exactly that: "You won't win." And that I found interesting because instead of I thought like it was. As I've since discovered, it's a reflection of how people choose to support candidates rather than looking at candidates and looking at their quality and their capacity to do the work and their background and their track record and all of that. They just want to know that they're going to back a winning horse. So I think that's a big problem, not just for women in politics, but all of politics for PNG, because then you don't end up attracting the caliber of leader that the country needs. You just end up attracting a popular person, or you know, who might not necessarily, you know, they might be well known, and there's a big, you know, obviously people here, it's a very communal tribal culture here, so people will jump on a bandwagon of someone popular and would rather be seen to be in the winning camp than even if they, you know, they might be totally incapable for the job. So but you know, I can understand why the term courageous is used a lot. I think that many women here don't have the, I guess I've had the privilege of my two parents and the family that I grew up in and the example of my mother. So there are very few Papua New Guinean women who can say in this case, stepping up to the plate to run in an election, that they are following in the footsteps of their mother. Most, you know, there is a candidate actually contesting against me, a woman. She's a lawyer. She's a fantastic woman. And she is the daughter of a former candidate, but it's her father she's following in the footsteps of. So I feel like, you know, my mother broke the ground. She did the groundwork. She laid the foundations, and I really have no excuse but to honour her legacy and build upon what foundations she gave to me.
Mm. Yeah, we've brought this up before. We've had a chat about legacy candidates as another person that I chatted with framed it. Do you think that it's beneficial to your campaign to be able to use the networks and the ground that your mother broke and your uncles broke before you? Do you think that has helped you with your campaign so far?
Well, just let me clarify that we're not campaigning right now. Campaigning begins on the 28th of April, and we have laws in the country that prevent early campaigning. It will disqualify me if I start doing that. But we're doing awareness. So just awareness around, voting, education around who I am, who I am, my background. I don't lean too much on, like, my mother was not a high profile candidate because it was the first elections, it was the 70s. So there's not a lot of, you know, record keeping, and, you know, and because she was unsuccessful, people only tend to remember, you know, the winner and not the other candidates. But she was the only woman at that time when she was standing in her seat. She was the only woman. So it does help people to give confidence. The other part to it where I talk about my family a lot is that I'm of mixed parentage. So my father is an Australian. And so it's important, there is that perception that I'm a white lady and I, you know, what do I know about Papua New Guinea? So that's another very interesting thing, because when I worked in Australia, I was a person of colour. Here I'm the opposite. I try very much. I have so much respect for my family, my family name, that I don't want to throw them around cheaply. So I use it. I do tell my story, just so that people know that I'm from here. I'm from here. I have a history here. I was born and raised here. And of course, everybody knows that our parents and our family environment is the single biggest influence that shapes a person and who they are. So I do talk about my family, but I would be talking about them anyway if they were not politicians, you know, if they were not political, or if, you know, I talk a lot about my mother as a businesswoman. And, you know, as a businesswoman in the 70s, trying to go and get bank loans from the bank while pregnant with my brothers, you know, and this is like, she was a groundbreaking feminist and activist, you know, on global standards, not just by Papua New Guinean standards back in the 70s. You know, I'm fortunate that I had a great feminist father. So he supported my mother in everything that she did. So I would talk about my family anyway. But I don't want to use that their achievements, you know, their legacy as the reason, as the only reason. But I think that when I do talk about them, I talk about it in that context of family environment and your mum and dad being the biggest influences a person can have. And I use it also to encourage parents to think about that when they're parenting their children, that, you know, you can send your children, you can worry about what school they go to, you can worry about this and that, but the thing that's going to make or break them really at the end of the day is family, is their family and how their family home and their family life and what support they get from their family is.
Mm. And they sound like amazing role models to have. I'd like to talk about the next steps now. You have an amazing story where you were one of four women that was endorsed for all seats in the National Capital District for your political party. So tell me about how you secured that spot. Were there others lined up for it as well? And did the party approach you or did you approach the party?
Well, this is my party. As in my work since I've returned home for the last 5 years, I have worked very closely with Sir Peter Ipetus, who is the founder of the People's Party. You know, it's known as a very male, macho, Highlands, you know, dominated party. Because of the work I was doing, I worked in development for the Yenga Provincial Government, developing tourism. So I just organically got involved in doing work for Sir Peter with the party. And I realised that I had a voice here. Contrary to what I expected, they were interested in hearing what I had to say around policy. And since 2017, since I realised, you know, that minute that we all recovered from the shock of zero women in Parliament, I have slowly been planting those seeds around, you know, you mentioned earlier, just the tiny percentage of women that contested, and the notion that if we want women in Parliament, well, we've got to be in the race, and the best way to be in the race is if parties start endorsing candidates. So the notion, you know, the discussions around the notion of gender quotas for women with parties, so they, you know, parties must endorse a certain percentage of women candidates. That's become People's Party policy now. The policy wants to see that more responsibility put onto political parties in endorsing women. And so then we had a by-election here in late last year, and so People's Party started that movement by endorsing a woman, and then I obviously expressed that I'm also going to be putting my hand up to contest in the 2022 election. The immediate response was, okay, great, maybe we'll just endorse all women for the NCD. And wow, what a powerful statement. I mean, this is unprecedented. It's not happened before. By all accounts, it sent shockwaves when the announcement came out. No one was expecting it. Okay, it just sent shockwaves through the establishment, and it's resulted in other parties scrambling now to find women candidates to endorse. So I feel like I've already had a win. I feel like, you know, I've had a massive win here. This is something that was really driven by Sir Peter Ipetas. I could not predict how good the reaction would be to it at all. And when the reaction started coming, I just thought, this guy's a visionary. He really knows what he's doing. In the National Capital District is probably the ideal district to run women because it's the capital. It's a modern, you know, its population is more exposed to, you know, modern mindsets and modern ways of doing things. So it's easier for them to accept women, easier for them to accept the idea of electing women. But also, you know, this is not just the electorate aren't ready for it. You know, people did their groundwork and did a lot of listening, and the electorate are ready to really seriously put women in to have a go. It's the 11th election in the history of Papua New Guinea that we're going to. And so people now have that opportunity that people can look back at the previous election and the election before, and there is that awakening that we can't just keep doing the same things and expecting different results. So it's unprecedented. It was an historic announcement, and I really think that these very high profile seats in the national, all the seats in our national capital, they're high profile seats, and to entrust them and to give the confidence to women sends a powerful message that I think will resonate for elections to come. I think we'll see even more women, because it's probably too late for women to now, you know, feed off us and our step forward and put their hand up for this election, but they can certainly start planning and getting ready for next election. Every little step does count. It really does count.
And what an outcome as well for all the endorsement of the women in your party to spur on other political parties to search for women to endorse as candidates as well. I think that's just fabulous. Now, you touched on before about campaigning in an urban setting, or being a candidate in an urban setting. So what do you think are the differences for women that are going to be campaigning in the rural provinces, and how is it going to be different for you in your urban setting?
Yeah, so I think the challenges that the rural people face more around access, because in the advantages, I guess, of an urban setting is that I can easily visit all corners of my electorate. I don't have to, you know, get on a dinghy. I don't have to get a chopper. I don't have to trek for days. I can jump in my car, albeit I do need a four-wheel drive car because of the road conditions into many of the communities. The road conditions in, once you get off the main road to Port Moresby, it's off-road driving. So, I mean, that's my only challenge has been maintaining my shock absorbers on my car. In an urban environment, the candidates really do have to spend a lot more time out there. Like I can go out and visit a community and come home every night and sleep in my bed, whereas they have to plan and go out for a week and take a tent and, you know, trek. And one of my close friends and good sisters, Kessie Sawang, is contesting in an electorate in Madang, and you know, she's got fuel costs for dinghies and then fuel costs for vehicles, so she's got to cover coast and mountains, and I mean, it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal what the candidates in our rural areas, you know, we are one of the most rugged places on earth as well, and there's, you know, the transport infrastructure is, you know, pretty much non-existent once you get out of the urban centres. So, you know, that they've got that. That's, I would say, the biggest challenge for those in the rural candidates. In the urban setting, it's more like they call these seats, these NCD seats. The nickname for them is the money seats. And I didn't know what they were talking about, the money seats, but now I do. It basically, what they're referring to is the fact that candidates spend an extraordinary and phenomenal amount of money on their campaigns. You know, we are talking millions of kina. And so there is also the campaign culture, which is just handouts and, you know, just literally handouts. I mean, and, you know, some of it's masked as sports. They'll sponsor a sports tournament for a community, but, you know, it's just a kind of a vehicle to funnel cash in, you know, to give people handouts. So there's just literally just giving people $100 here, $50 there. So it's unfortunately become the culture, the voting culture of the capital city, where candidates are buying votes. So that also impacts the people themselves, because they end up making a choice for who they're going to vote for based on whether they gave them $100 or not. And I'm literally talking that much. Like, I'm not, it's very sad, the undervaluing of the true worth of their vote. So a lot of my conversations with community has just been around, you know, that idea that if you want change, you have to change the way in which you choose who you're going to vote for. Because you're choosing who you're going to vote for based on the wrong things. And you're choosing incompetent people just simply because they've had the most money to throw around. So, you know, it's been challenging but also rewarding to stick to my plan. I won't be spending extraordinary amounts of money in this campaign. I find it quite obscene to be spending those types of monies, you know, in campaigning in communities where there's just so much poverty. And then, you know, there's just such a big, you know, what are we, millionaires, and we can spend millions on a campaign? It's really obscene. It's really obscene. And it's sad. People are desperate. People are living hand to mouth. So it's very easy for them to take it, you know, and to they get taken advantage of. It's easy to buy a poor man's vote. And then it's not in the interest of those who get elected to then lift you out of that hand to mouth situation, because they need you to be vulnerable. They need you to be dependent so they can easily buy your vote again. So it's a cycle, and it's a cycle that needs to be broken.
Mm. And that's certainly a powerful message. You know, the way you go about change is a really powerful message to be getting out there. So let's talk a little bit more about the candidacy field in your electorate. Last election, 2017, there were 3,340 candidates that nominated across Papua New Guinea, and it was a slight increase on the 2012 election. So it's a huge candidacy group, and especially if you compare that with Australia, which has a population nearly three times the size of Papua New Guinea's, it has less than half of Papua New Guinea's candidacy field. Now let's talk about your electorate. How many candidates do you think you'll be going up against?
Well, in the last election, it was 53 or 52. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's insane. So it was the number. And in fact, we had in the seat that I'm running in five women candidates. It was the second highest number of women in one running for the one seat in the country. The highest was in the seat of Rigo, and then Northeast had the second highest number of women candidates contesting. So that makes me happy. You know, like I I want to see all women do well, even those that I'm contesting against. But yeah, look, it does make it challenging having 53 candidates. And this is one reason why the limited preferential voting system that PNG has is so important, because prior, you know, previously it was just first past the post, you know, you just put your X in the box and that's it. And there was a recent push by this current parliament to bring it back to that just first past the post, you know, one vote, X marks the spot voting, but the limited preferential voting system does make it fairer, and it just, you know, it just means candidates are strategic. They form agreements, and not as in, you know, they form partnerships, and we all have to cooperate to give each other, you know, our twos and our threes, and, you know, I'll give you twos, you give me your twos and threes, and etc. And it's, and the limited preferential voting system does tend to see women doing quite well. It also works very well in the sense that because of our tribal and communal culture, individuals don't tend to just go rock up and vote and cast their vote. It's their business and no one's going to interfere. Communities sit down and discuss who they're going to vote for. You know, so obviously the leaders of communities are very influential in this, and they vote in a block. So they'll go, right, all of us in this community, we're all going to vote for this person, and then we'll all, and so then you go, all right, well, they've got their tribal allegiances or whatever, so they'll vote for that person. But then you go and see them and go, just give me your twos, you know, just give me the twos. But yeah, the 52, it's insane. On the 52 candidates, that's about right. In some others, you know, it can go into the 60s. We also have an extraordinarily high number of political parties, which is also another characteristic of politics here as well. Just loads and loads of political parties that nobody really knows what they stand for. Predominantly, they're just created as a vehicle for the leader of said party to potentially have a crack at being prime minister. So that a lot of these political parties pop up without any clear policy or platform, or, you know, it's very much driven by whoever the leader of that party is what that party is.
It certainly makes the elections pretty complex.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your vision. If you get elected to Parliament, what's your vision, and do you think part of being a woman in Parliament after this election will be dedicated to reforming the legislation so that these temporary special measures can get through, so we can have a dedicated reserve seating for women? What do you think your vision entails?
Okay, so in terms of the temporary special measures and reserve seats, I am not a supporter of that. So I think that people don't quite understand the nuances of Papua New Guinea and are driving this thing, not knowing that it's actually going to be the worst thing that could happen, because it'll just cement us in our position forever we'll just give them reserve seats all the time. That's what's going to happen. That's the way Papua New Guinean men think. I'm not a supporter of reserve seats. I think that we need to do the work and get in the normal way. I'm much more in favour of seeing political parties really get behind women, fully get behind women, and endorse them. And also just in general, in terms of support to assist women to contest. So the challenges that face women, you know, it, like I already alluded to, it's very expensive to run for Parliament here. I would be very curious to know what the average spend is for candidates in PNG and compare it to other parts of the world. But, you know, those figures that you mentioned earlier about Australia, you know, in terms of the number of candidates, I would say if you broke down the cost per candidate on an average that out, and you did the same for PNG, you would see an equally, you know, high number. equally disproportionately high number. So I feel like women are already disadvantaged because of the gender pay gap, because of general wealth disparity between, you know, men and women. So we're behind the eight ball with getting financial support. And then you add to that the fact that when I said earlier how people will back a candidate if they think they're going to win. So donors who want to fund and support a candidate are less likely to support and fund a female candidate simply because not because they don't think they'll be any good, but because they think they won't win and so they'll be wasting their money. So I think that people just need to support candidates better. The reserve seat. I mean, I know that I don't actively go around trying to, you know, prevent the reserve seats, and I don't speak on it very often. But that, you know, I know that there's that assumption that we all want reserve seats, but I don't. I really don't. I think it's going to morph into something that will just hold us in our place forever. It won't work the way that people are expecting it to work. Just because it worked in other places this way, it does not mean that it will work this way in Papua New Guinea. And I say this time and time again about so many things that get so many ideas and concepts and projects that get kind of transplanted into my country, and a lot of money gets wasted on these new initiatives, and they don't work because it's some fabulous, you know, it's some consultant that's maybe done some great work in another part of the world think they can just roll out the same thing in PNG. It doesn't work. Millions have been spent on trying to address gender-based violence in PNG. So much money and none of it's working. It's getting worse. It's not improving. So that's because we keep getting forced to take the projects that are not homegrown, that don't really reflect the nuances of Papua New Guinea. And, you know, unfortunately, beggars can't be choosers. If someone's trying to help us, you know, we'll have a go and we'll accept that, you know, funding for that. But it's not going to be effective. And so that's why I sort of feel like reserve seats is exactly the same. It's a similar thing. It's a project that I feel like has been kind of pushed upon us, that if you look back historically at when all this started coming, being discussed and where it was coming from, it's been pushed upon us. And it's become very popular. But I just don't think it's going to work. At all. I bumped into the Prime Minister 2 days ago, and he talked about his solution. He had a solution whereby he was thinking, I don't know if I should tell you this, but anyway, I'll tell you, cut it out later. He said, I think it's a good idea. I mean, I think it's a little bit better than reserve seats in that if at the end of this election we don't end up with any women in parliament, because I'm feeling like we will, there will be more women running this time around, and I also feel like the population is ready. But if we don't, he said, we'll just look at the results from the best performing woman candidate from the New Guinea side, and we'll look at the best performing candidate from the Papua side, and we'll put those two in, and they can sit there for a 5-year term. And even then, I'm still a bit nervous about that. I wouldn't want to be. I was just thinking, gosh, what if I'm one of those? What would I do? Would I actually accept the position? I mean, am I really in there? Do I have the same voting rights? Do I have the same powers? Will I be, you know, treated the same? I don't think so. I mean, I might have the same rights, but I just feel like it would be better to go in with full power, full equality, full everything. You know, I'm a believer in you set the foundations for how you want to go, how you want the outcome to be from the get-go. And if we set the foundations, we want to be in there on the same road, walking the same path with the same rights and through the same channel as every other citizen, male or female, that's the outcome we want ultimately. So let's just start that way the way we want it to finish. That's my attitude towards reserve seats.
Yeah, no, and it's really great to hear an alternative perspective on this. You brought up that the consultants aren't producing homegrown programs that aren't reflecting what's needed in Papua New Guinea. So what about the Australian government? Do you think it has a role to play here to better support women in Papua New Guinea? And how do you think they could do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I, of course, I'm a great friend of Australia. I have two sons who are Australian. I have two great grandsons who are Australian. So I definitely think Australia has a role to play. I definitely want to see Australia play a bigger role. I think that my experience has been that we've got to stop just ticking boxes. You know, we've really got to stop ticking boxes, and I feel like there's been a lot of that. Like, let's just tick a box and let's just half do it. And I've got a lot to say about Australia. I'm very grateful to Australia always for its, and I value greatly the special relationship that we have with Australia that we have with no other country. I would like to see, from the flip side, I feel like there is a lack of consciousness about Papua New Guinea in Australia, as opposed to, I mean, Papua New Guineans all know about Australia. There are Papua New Guinean children who could sing the national anthem start to finish. I saw it once at a Anzac Day ceremony when the Australian national anthem played, and I looked up and all the PNG kids were singing Advance Australia Fair start to finish word by word. And then I thought, I worked for Behind the News and Current Affairs program that's broadcast in all Australian schools. And I've been to many Australian schools. None of them would even know where Papua New Guinea is, let alone sing our national anthem. So I think that there's an imbalance there. And so I think if we need, from a Papua New Guinean perspective, it would be nice if Australians more broadly knew about us and who we truly are, and not just the cliches, not just the stereotypes, not just the corruption and the cannibalism and the sorcery and the violence and the, you know, to know our history better and our story. I know that, you know, Sean Dorney talks about this a lot. So what I'm saying is not new. It's been talked about a lot, but that's the kind of imbalance we see. This is a really big topic. It's kind of off the topic of politics, but it's something that I'm really passionate about too. I would like for the work that Australia does in my country to be more effective, and I think it can be. I just need to really sit down and unpack it better. In fact, it's part of the things that, you know, should I be successful and go in, I will be looking to my father's country for partnerships, for support, you know, as an MP. It's very much in the policies of the party that I'm standing in, is to align ourselves with Australia more, in areas like addressing law and order, in areas like improving the standard of education. It's all there in our party policy, and it's Australia, Australia, Australia. We are your champions as far as political parties go in this country. Make no mistake about that. And I would like to think partly my influence, but also partly that like-mindedness of the party founder, who also has that, he also looks to Australia very much as, you know, our most important friend. More than friend, actually. It's way more than friend. You see, now I'm starting to get emotional. It's way more than just friends. Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly building that knowledge and awareness of Papua New Guinea in Australia is something that needs more work here in Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
Tanya, I have one final question for you. Do you have a message for any women or girls that are aspiring to become a candidate in future elections in Papua New Guinea? What sort of advice would you give to them?
Okay, yes. First of all, if you're thinking about it, good. If you're thinking about it, good on you. The thing is that you need to plan. You can't just decide 5 minutes out of the game that you want to play. Start thinking about it now for next year. Start looking around for like-minded people that share your vision to align yourself with. Start looking for support. If you have a particular political party that you like, go and get involved with the party. Go and do the work at the party level, not as a candidate, as a supporter of the party. And that's a way that, you know, the party can recognize you and who you are. They will get to know you. They will realize that actually you're an asset to this party, because, you know, most women that would be thinking of contesting, you know, they would definitely have some substance to them in order for them to be thinking that way. So go and start working with a party, or, like, you know, give me a call. I'm happy to help guide and steer you in the right direction, because really, that's, yes, I want to win my seat, but at the end of the day, win, lose or draw, I want to show more women that it's doable, that you can contest. There's no shame if you don't win. It's okay. Recognize that, yes, it's going to be hard. It's hard for the men too, but it is harder for the women. Recognize, you know, think carefully about, you know, how you're going to fund your campaign and the impact that it's going to have on your life. You know, you do have to be realistic. Women also have the added responsibility of being the primary caregiver if they've got children in the home. One of my candidates is a single mother. She's got a four-year-old and she's contesting. So we as a team, you know, the four women that are, the three other women that are lining up under the People's Party banner, we are very grateful for that with the party, because we are able to support each other. And, you know, the challenges that we face in terms of gearing up for the campaign and throughout the campaign that only women have, we will understand that and be able to support our fellow candidates. So I encourage all girls to put their hand up. You know, if you think that you have always wanted to be a member of parliament, then maybe you should try, because it's a calling. It's a calling. You'll know if you're supposed to do it. You'll feel it. That you know, well, this is my experience. I've tried, like I said, I've tried to run away from it. I've just thought, my goodness, no, I don't want that life. But at the end of the day, I also feel like if you feel it and it keeps coming back to you, and you can't shake that feeling that you want to try and get into parliament, you want to get in there and make a difference, then just listen to that calling and give me a call. I'm happy to help any Papua New Guinean woman or girl to take that step and put their hat in the ring, and let's see more of us in the big house of parliament.
Gee, Tanya, that was an inspiring message. I think you're going to get a few calls after this podcast is aired. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to discuss such an important topic with me, and for no doubt inspiring the next generation of female candidates in Papua New Guinea too. We wish you all the very best during the election and into the future. You've been listening to the Oz PNG Network's Women in Politics series, a Lowy Institute podcast developed with production assistance from Darcy Milne and Josh Goading. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode.